I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. The interwoven history of Great Britain and India is one not only of colonial exploitation, that's a big part of the story, of course, but also a history of occasional cross-pollination. I'm thinking right now of a man named Albert Howard, an Englishman who trained as a botanist at Cambridge, then received various academic posts throughout the British Empire. In other words, he was sent from the mother country to go out and teach other people. And what was he to teach them? Well, Western agricultural techniques and practices. But when he arrived in India, soon enough, he had to prove himself humble enough to be taught instead of merely exporting knowledge in one direction, in a less developed place, as he had supposed. And what was he taught in India? He was taught about gardening, farming, food production, soil fertility, composting, the interdependence of humans with animals and plants, and not to be forgotten, with soil. Not dirt, inert dirt, but healthy, active, living, fertile soil. Albert Howard's name eventually became legendary in a movement often called organic farming, organic agriculture, organic gardening, as long as the word organic's in there somewhere. If you go to the grocery store today and purchase foods that are labeled organic, he, Albert Howard, is one of the movers and shakers behind this whole concept. Well, I've begun with Albert Howard, later Sir Albert Howard, which means that somebody in Great Britain thought highly enough of him to grant him that very special title, Sir. I've started with him because I want to give some credit where I think a fair amount of credit is probably due as we talk about somebody else altogether, a person who learned from Howard some principles that Howard had learned from farmers in India. Lewis Bromfield was a literary guy. He was a writer. He was raised by farming people, but turned into, you could say, a sophisticate, one of the literary elite. He hobnobbed with some pretty big names, Gertrude Stein, Edith Wharton, Ernest Hemingway. He was befriended by Hollywood luminaries like Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. He had a garden retreat outside of Paris, and it drew aristocrats and diplomats and fellow American expats to his place in outside of Paris because he was the coolest. He was popular. He was sensational, actually. People were in some kind of awe about him, maybe even a spell. And oh, did I mention his Pulitzer Prize? He was a novelist. But somehow, this Lewis Bromfield made his way to India, and that's how he met Albert Howard. And that's where he began to learn more and more about the glories of compost and manure and fertile soil. Later in his career, this Lewis Bromfield, no matter how hard he tried, could only lead a few people back to the farm, back to the principles that he had learned about how to keep soil healthy. So he, you could say, helped to promulgate a movement, a slow movement of organic farming. And it was slow enough that his name almost dropped out together from history altogether. Almost. But there is now a biography about this Lewis Bromfield. It's just out. It's intended to square up his legacy with the truth about his influence, far-ranging influence. The Lewis Bromfield, once known far and wide across not only America but across the world as a famous author, a literary man. His comment there flamed out, too. He may still have something to teach us about soil. I am very delighted to introduce you to Stephen Heyman, who is a writer. Maybe he mirrors Lewis Bromfield in a way, too. He's turned his pen to the matter of soil and organic or agrarian thinking in this biography of Bromfield. Stephen Heyman has written for the New York Times, for Slate, Vogue, and many other publications. His biography is titled The Planter of Modern Life, Lewis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution. Stephen Heyman, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
You know, your story of bumping into the name Bromfield is an interesting one, and it took you away from the city a bit, I guess.
That's right. I guess it was 2015 in the fall. I had recently moved to Pittsburgh with my wife, who came here to pursue graduate work, and I was looking for stories, and I happened to meet a lamb farmer who himself is considered to be something of an early adopter in the world of sustainable agriculture. His name is John Jameson. He had been inspired. He was an English major. He and his wife didn't have any farming background, but they came in touch with Bromfield's books in the 70s, and it led them on this path. And they discovered things like intensive rotational grazing and a lot of different sustainable techniques. And they became farmers. And I think I wrote down Bromfield's name in my notebook. And when I got home, just typed his name into Google, and I dropped down this marvelous rabbit hole where I discovered a personality who had been consequential in two kind of divergent fields, one literature, another agriculture, but who for some reason had kind of vanished from popular memory. And I thought, kind of instantly, I was like seduced by the contours of the story, and I felt like, how do those two worlds connect, literature and agriculture? And I thought perhaps there's a book here. And 5 years later, here we are.
Well, can you give us some kind of a sense for just how big his name was in his heyday? Because with novels translated into various languages around the world, he was, what, Hemingway or better?
Yeah, I would say that he was considered by the literary establishment to be a more promising writer in the 1920s than either Hemingway or Fitzgerald. And now, of course, it's challenging to find his books, and certainly very few people read him. But in his day, he was a best-selling novelist. His first book came out in 1924, The Green Bay Tree. His third book, Early Autumn, won the Pulitzer Prize, that was in 1927. And there was a critic who wrote in the Times that year who basically said that Bromfield was the very best of all young American novelists. Like many writers in that period, to take advantage of advantageous economics and because of the very exciting cultural things that were happening in Paris, he moved in 1925 and became an expat. But unlike Hemingway and a lot of other writers who settled in the Left Bank, Bromfield very quickly moves out of the city to this provincial town called Senlis. And while he's writing novels, he's also gardening and learning from his peasant neighbors about the kind of almost sacred French concept of terroir, the importance of the soil. And he's learning lots of different techniques for how to basically grow lots of food in a very small space and be extraordinarily frugal and grow delicious vegetables. And what's interesting about this period, so now we're in the 1930s, and Bromfield has this kind of exquisite life. He's very close friends with Edith Wharton, who also was a big gardener. Every Sunday he's hosting parties in this garden, which is set along a river. But the world around him is kind of falling apart. In America, there is the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, farmers are being dispossessed by their land by the millions. And he is thinking a lot about, I guess, what you'd call it, sustainability. He didn't use that term at the time, but he's thinking about that. And basically, he writes in 1933 a novel called The Farm. And it's a kind of very romantic autobiographical novel all about his family and his grandparents who were farmers. And it kind of glorifies their agrarian existence. And it sets him on a path that ultimately leads him back to Ohio, back to his native soil, and away from literature and toward agriculture.
I think it's very important that you mentioned that he has these roots in the farming family, because it's not just a city guy who goes to Paris who thinks, I'm going to take up a garden out there. He had sort of this legacy.
Absolutely. He was raised in the city of Mansfield. He kind of was hanging on to the bottom rung of the middle class. His mother had grown up on a farm, and his grandfather, when he was a young boy, still had the farm. And for Bromfield, he loved everything about farming. It was extremely stimulating to him, and he felt that his grandfather's farm, much more than his home in the city, was his true home. That's where he felt most comfortable. But his grandfather lost that farm, and that was kind of an initial trauma for him. And in a way, his life could be seen as an attempt to get back to his grandfather's farm. Of course, there were several disillusioning episodes along the way, because the vision that he had of his grandfather's farm was intensely romantic. It culminated in that novel, that 1933 novel, The Farm. But when Bromfield actually returned to America in 1938 and began to build his farm, he ran into a lot of obstacles, both systemic obstacles having to do with the way agriculture is what was being practiced at the time, and personal ones.
So, is this a man then who knew how to farm, or was it just sort of the family value?
Well, he had learned a tremendous amount about gardening in France, and he knew the basics, the kind of old-fashioned basics of farming, from working on his grandfather's farm as a young kid, as an adolescent. But so basically, in 1938, Bromfield leaves Europe. He's disgusted by Chamberlain, by appeasement. He leaves in a huff. He sees what's coming. And he wants to come back to Ohio and raise his kids on an honest to God farm. So it's winter, and he's driving near his native city of Mansfield in a valley called Pleasant Valley, and he finds an old farmhouse, which he thinks he remembers from his youth. It's a very romantic situation with tall trees and a stream running through this valley. And he buys 600 acres. And then the snow melts in the spring. And he realizes that this dream farm that he's bought, actually, the soil is completely worthless. It was this sandy, loose, alluvial topsoil, which had been washed off the hills. And Bromfield basically is, of course, very upset, but he decides that he's going to try to transform this land. And in the process, he kind of transforms himself by learning the principles of soil conservation and applying some of the ideas on a larger scale that he had learned from gardening in France and from his travels in India. So he names his farm Malabar, taking an Indian name because it was financed with profits from his Indian novel The Rains Came, which was turned into a huge Hollywood blockbuster film in 1939, and hires a kid from a smart kid from Ohio State, who at the time was connected to a lot of New Deal organizations like the Soil Conservation Service and the Civilian Conservation Corps, who were kind of on the cutting edge of soil science, and they together work to transform Malabar from this eroded hill farm into a showcase for modern agriculture. And Bromfield parlays all of his charisma, because he was an extremely charismatic man, into this new role as a kind of evangelist for what he calls the new agriculture. And he hosts hundreds of people at his farm, and he goes on these barnstorming tours around the country, really inspiring lots of people. And then he writes a series of agricultural memoirs beginning in 1945 with Pleasant Valley, and they become bestsellers, and they convert a number of people, and this was kind of a kind of back to the land period. A lot of the time, at the time, a lot of people were coming out of the military service, and a number of people became farmers from reading Bromfield. They wanted to build their own Malabar. So he was an extraordinarily inspiring figure in his time.
So he's been to Paris. He's lived there for some time. He's had his garden. He's a person of apparently immense means to buy a 600-acre farm with a Hollywood hit, and with his book sales, with a Pulitzer Prize. He's got the means to do this.
Right.
How long had he been in India and learned from someone like Sir Albert Howard? Was that I know there are many, many people that factor into his learning about the soil, but would you say that he went to India and just happened to bump into Howard, or did he go there with a purpose?
Well, so it kind of grew out of a naive interest. As I mentioned, Bromfield hosted all types of people in his garden. And among the people that he hosted were Maharajas and Maharanis, these wealthy Indian royals who tended to spend a lot of time in Europe. And in return for the hospitality that he showed them, they invited him to their palaces. And so he went on these long, elaborate tours, two of them, one in 1933 and one a little bit later in the 1930s. And he spent months traveling around India. He spent a lot of time in the state of Baroda, which is in present-day Gujarat. And he, India was inspirational in so many ways, from connecting him with Albert Howard, to providing the setting for some of his best-known fiction, to providing the name of his farm, Malabar, to giving him this whole concept of the cycle of life. This idea of what Howard calls the rule of return, the idea that we have to return to the soil what we take from it. It was an extremely inspiring place for Bromfield, though he, you know, only went on two long trips there.
I kind of get the impression that he was a bit of a sponge in the sense that he would absorb ideas. But with a native disposition to think about farming, given his family background, he just gravitated there and had a genuine, earnest interest in farming, even though he'd had this stellar career in the literary circles. He was pulled back. It's almost as though he couldn't have done otherwise. Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that Bromfield loved life in all of its manifestations. He was very curious about people. His friend, the New Yorker correspondent, Janet Flanner, said he used to collect people and note their value the way some men collect stamps. But not only people. He loved watching his beef cattle in a field of Ladino clover. He loved watching the mischievous raccoon steal his corn. He loved both kings and maharajas and French peasants and kind of salt of the earth farmers. So, you know, this is a guy who finds a lot of things sexy and interesting, and he's a guy who, in his time, confused a lot of people. And I think that because he was so omnivorous, and because he spread himself thin, this partially explains why, despite his many achievements, he's been forgotten.
We're visiting with Stephen Hayman about his new biography titled The Planter of Modern Life, Lewis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution. We're going to take a short break and come right back to speak some more with Stephen Hayman and come from India back again. I know it's been a circuitous route and we haven't been strictly chronological, but we're going to go to the Malabar, where Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall eventually are married and have their honeymoon, a famous place, even a state park today in the state of Ohio. After this short break here on Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a great pleasure to have with us Stephen Hayman. We are visiting with Hayman about his new biography of Lewis Bromfield titled The Planter of Modern Life, Lewis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution. Stephen, the seeds of a food revolution. Lots of foodies today. Lots of people concerned about what they're eating, where it comes from. Is it sustainable? This is apparently a story you're telling that goes back decades before the current wave of interest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm a child of the American suburbs, and I grew up in the 1980s and early 90s, you know, without any notion really of where my food came from. You know, food to me was wishbone salad dressing, Velveeta cheese. I think fish was chicken of the sea. It was a lot of fast food, junk food, TV dinners. I'm kind of amazed at what I ate and that I'm still relatively healthy. But I was totally ignorant of where the food I ate came from and what was in it. And I certainly didn't know any farmers or any gardeners. And when I got a bit older and got more interested in food and more educated about it, I became uncomfortable with the distance, both the real distance and the figurative distance between me and the farm where my food was grown. And I began to understand from reading authors like Wendell Berry and Joan Gassow and Michael Pollan and Dan Barber, you know, that our food system is very deeply screwed up, for lack of a better word, and in culturally, environmentally, ethically. And what I'm trying to argue in this book is that this list of popular voices articulating the problems with the modern food system, that list really begins with Bromfield.
Yeah, and the thing that's so fascinating is that someone like Bromfield doesn't get credit because in the narrative about the environmental movement, it's like all roads pass through Rachel Carson, right? And we give her credit for calling attention to DDT. And he was thinking about this a couple decades before that.
Absolutely. You know, I think that Silent Spring, Carson's Silent Spring, is kind of the culmination of a movement that really begins in the 1930s and 40s. And Bromfield is at the vanguard of that. You know, he warned Americans about DDT 17 years before Silent Spring, basically as soon as it came out in 1945, and testified in front of a congressional hearing, basically saying what you know, food nutritionists and soil scientists were unwilling to say, which is that this is a patent medicine, that it screws up the natural balance of nature, that he's seen the evidence himself in the field of birds and fish who died in a wholesale fashion by the application of DDT, and that we need to be very careful. And, you know, it's startling to me that someone could be so perceptive and so influential in his own time and be kind of forgotten by history. So I was very grateful for the opportunity to tell his story.
But you take pains to point out that he's a pragmatic guy as well, that he's not just about holing up in some antiquated way of farming. You mentioned that if he were alive today, maybe he'd be happy to use robotics to do his farming.
That's right. I think he would be farming with robots. I think he would have millions of followers on Twitter. I think that he would, you know, be getting into fights with people on television. I think that he would be very much in the public square, and I think that he would be kind of leading the charge toward a new kind of agriculture and a better relationship with the land. I think that it's true that we have agrarian writers today, some of whom write beautifully and influentially about our relationship with the land, but they seem to sequester themselves in a kind of pastoral solitude. And there's something a little, you know, atavistic or old-fashioned about their lifestyle. They want to return to some former way of being. Bromfield wasn't like that. He was a modernist, and that's kind of why I call that's why that's why the book's called The Planter of Modern Life. Though this is a historical figure, it's someone from whom we can learn a lot today, and someone who was ahead of his time.
Well, I want to learn a little bit about you. You mentioned him without naming him. Was it Max Drake, the fellow he hired back to be his farm manager at Malabar?
That's correct.
So this Max Drake is an interesting figure in my mind because you tell us such a wonderful little anecdote about, I guess, Bromfield leaves the farm for a while, and when he comes back, Drake has undertaken a lot of changes, and Bromfield isn't happy at first and throws a bit of a fit. But then he learns from Drake.
Right. So in the late 1930s, Bromfield engages Drake to help essentially turn these 600 acres, a number of worn out farms that he had bought, into a modern agricultural operation. But he also is deluded enough to think that he kind of understands everything about agriculture because he wrote a whole book about his grandparents farming, and he, built this beautiful 2-acre garden in France. The truth is, he doesn't know anything about modern agriculture, and certainly the project of restoring 600 acres is something beyond him. So he empowers Drake, and he at the time he's spending a lot of time in Hollywood, and Drake invites in workers from the Civilian Conservation Corps and a soil scientist from the Federal Soil Conservation Service, and begins to bulldoze the deep gullies and to refit the land. And Bromfield comes back from Hollywood while this is happening, and he blows his top, freaks out, starts cursing at Drake. Drake thinks he's fired, but then. And Bromfield storms off to his 17-room Greek Revival manor house, which he built at Malabar. But then shortly after he comes back, he's cooled off, and he says to Drake, "What the hell is going on here? I'm curious. Teach me. Tell me." And this is the beginning of his transformation. This is the begin. So as much as he could be arrogant, he also could be humble enough to learn new things.
And the things that he learned from Drake had to do with it goes back to the Dust Bowl problem. Why was the soil disappearing? How do you prevent erosion? What kinds of practices can enhance soil rather than diminish it? That kind of thing.
Absolutely. So, I mean, they were plowing, they decided to use cover crops to plow on the contour, the natural contour of the land, instead of basically growing crops straight up and down. They did large scale composting. They applied ground limestone to the land. They shut the cattle out from the woods so that and planted new seedlings. They used they interplanted different crops to cut down erosion and built up soil fertility. So there's a host of techniques which today are kind of the bedrock of sustainable agriculture, but at the time were very cutting edge, and very few farmers in the valley were using these practices, and their land was suffering as a result. So Bromfield's farm became a huge attraction among agriculturalists. And people came from all around the country and eventually all around the world to visit and learn from him. And maybe this is a good time to talk about a remarkable organization that Bromfield
Yes, please.
was part of called the Friends of the Land. And this was so the Friends of the Land, basically, a group of like-minded men and women from business, from government, from academia, people like Aldo Leopold, the noted ecologist and nature writer, Paul Sears, an Ohio ecologist, Henry Wallace, the former Secretary of Agriculture and then Roosevelt's vice president. All these people were involved in this completely forgotten but fantastically interesting organization called the Friends of the Land, which basically fanned out across the country and was promoting environmentalism before that word really existed, and the interconnectedness of all aspects of nature, from soil to animal health to human health to water conservation. And Bromfield was this organization's star speaker, and Malabar was its kind of showcase. So it's remarkable how successful they were, even though they began basically at the outset of World War II. But nevertheless, they published a very influential journal called The Land, and they had a documentary film made that was kind of the inconvenient truth of its time. So a very important forgotten chapter in American environmental history, I think.
I think he's such a colorful figure, this Lewis Bromfield, and seemingly had the humility, at least enough, to learn from a host of different people. I'm curious to know if he was transformed by various views of sustainability, as we call it today, and land care. How changed are you from having spent 5 years or more in studying this? Have you appreciably changed?
I will tell you that I've planted a victory garden on the patio of my one-bedroom apartment in Pittsburgh, which I think is as much a reflection of my interest in these topics and Bromfield's story as it is our very unusual moment we're living in, where we're spending so much time at home and necessarily preoccupied with questions of how to live and questions of sustainability. I'm sure this story has changed me in a number of ways. I've been spending so much time thinking about it. I haven't reflected much on what how it's affected my way of thinking, but I'm sure I care even more about where my food comes from. But I also must admit to a certain amount of helplessness, because I think that as much as organic farming, sustainability, and these issues are at the fore right now, it seems like our environmental problems are increasing at an even faster rate. And I wonder whether there is the will or the capacity for society to make some serious changes in the way that we approach our land and our food system. And I wish that we had people like Bromfield today who could inspire more people toward a better direction.
And when it comes to those spokespersons that we might be in need of, would they correspond to the Humphrey Bogarts and Lauren Bacall who show up on a farm to get married? I mean, were they in a way lending their fame to a cause?
I don't know if they were consciously doing that, but I think Bromfield knew what effect it would have to host a Hollywood wedding like Bogart and Bacall's wedding. And he very shrewdly capitalized on the publicity that Malabar got as a celebrity, this kind of strange rural retreat for celebrities, to promote some of the agricultural and environmental ideas that he was working on. So, when somebody like E.B. White writes a poem in The New Yorker all about Malabar Farm, which happened in 1948, people are going to get interested, and that interest is going to naturally lead them to, some of Bromfield's ideas. And so perhaps that would move the needle a little bit about on where America was agriculturally. So I think that he was very good at publicity and PR even before that term really existed.
Finally, I just have to guess, and I'm just guessing that the intervention of World War II, that put the end to his garden, his stay in the environs of Paris. He just gave that up and started afresh, and maybe that garden in Senlis in France was kind of a ramp-up for him doing Malabar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was. And, Bromfield wrote 30 some odd books. His agricultural books are still cherished by farmers today. But I think that the landscapes he created, both that garden on the river outside of Paris and Malabar Farm, which, as you mentioned, is today a state park and it is a truly beautiful place. I wish I were there right now. Were his true masterpieces. So I think that as much as he was a literary artist, maybe he was even more of an artist when it came to landscape.
Stephen Hayman, such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you, and congratulations on the completion and publication of this biography. Such a delight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Stephen Hayman with us, a writer who is author of The Planter of Modern Life, Lewis Bromfield, and The Seeds of a Food Revolution. Next on Constant Wonder, we'll take a look at a farm in England that practices a land management philosophy not at all far removed from Bromfield's organic approaches. Constant Wonder continues in a moment. On Constant Wonder this hour, we've been talking about the 20th century roots of what has often been styled the organic farming movement. We just heard the story of novelist, environmentalist, and organic farming pioneer Lewis Bromfield. Let's take a trip now to the Knepp Farm in England. It's a 3,500-acre plot of land that was wholly unproductive as a farm because of years of poor cultivation, bad farming practices. After trying to run the farm for several years, Isabella Tree and her husband decided to switch gears completely, turning to a hands-off conservation technique called rewilding. The results have been astonishing. Along with managing this land, Isabella Tree is a journalist and the author of Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. I'm pleased to introduce you to her and the quest that she's undertaken. Isabella Tree, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
I want to begin with a very simple question about your daily opportunity to be out and about on the Knepp Estate, silent K, K-N-E-P-P, this vast tract of land that was inherited by your husband. Tell us, if you would, do you get out on this place?
Yes, I mean, we live right in the middle of it. So, you know, it's now nature right up to our doorstep. It's an amazing place to live now.
And I assumed that was the case because I knew it was your home. But I can't even imagine having the opportunity to do that, because if I were given 1 year to live, and if somebody were to tell me, pick a place, pick any place, I could do a lot worse than picking the Knepp Estate. I could enjoy, from what I've seen on YouTube of the place, I could enjoy most every day there. Are you up in the morning? Are you out there in midday? Are you out there evenings? Are you with listening to the owls at night? How much time?
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, you know, if you wake up, you know, and it's a lovely dawn morning and you wake up to surround sound birdsong, it just pulls you outside. 3 days ago, one of our Exmoors gave birth to a foal right outside the house. And we were alerted to this fact because we had five or six of the other Exmoor ponies standing around in a really strange formation, staring at the house. And we couldn't work out what they were doing. And they were guarding the female who was giving birth. It was absolutely extraordinary.
And I probably need to ask what an Exmoor is exactly. That's a breed I haven't heard of before.
Well, it's one of our oldest breeds of horse. So one of the sort of premises of what we've done at Knepp is really to introduce some of the animals that would have been proxy, that are proxies for what would have been roaming our landscape in pre-human impact times. So the kind of animals that would have been driving the landscape, driving the habitat creation, that would have co-evolved with our vegetation, because we are beginning to understand how these animals, the grazing and browsing megafauna, are keystone species in the way that they kickstart natural processes again. So we don't in Europe have the tarpan anymore. This is the sort of the ancestor of the European horse. Obviously, the horse originally came from America across the Bering Strait, but in Europe, it was known as the tarpan, and it became extinct several centuries ago. But we do have domesticated descendants, so breeds of horse that have become feral again, but that are phenotypically very similar to the original tarpan. And the Exmoor pony looks very like the cave paintings in Lascaux in France that are 17,500 years old. It's short and stocky. It's got this amazing ice tail. It's got eyes that it can kind of glaze over with a kind of protective layer of fat to kind of help protect it against ice flows and, I suppose, from the claws of predators. So it's a very kind of primeval-looking horse. And we really have introduced it onto our project to mimic the disturbance that these kind of horses would have created in the landscape thousands of years ago.
And that disturbance goes beyond just defecation, their excrement. That, I mean, that's important, I would imagine, to drive things along. What else do they do that's so important?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The dung is hugely important, and having sort of organic dung in the landscape, you know, and all the other insects that that feed and breed in dung, you know, that dung beetle is just as one example that pull that dung back into the soil. So that's a hugely important process of how to reignite the soil fertility. But they're also browsing and grazing in different ways, all these animals. So they have different preferences. They will take the bark off branches and twigs, for example. They'll self-medicate, take particular interest in certain herbs at different times of year if they want to boost their iron or mineral reserves. But there's some very interesting sort of relationship between equines and bovines, and that we're also just beginning to understand. Princeton University has been doing a project in Kenya, and it's very counterintuitive what they've discovered, but it's so much like so much of rewilding is counterintuitive in a way. But what they've discovered is that if you have 100 head of cattle grazing a certain area, they put on more condition, more weight, if they're allowed to graze with equines. So those equines could be a donkey, they could be ponies, they could even be zebra. But they'll put on more condition if they're grazing alongside them. And you'd think, well, surely they're competing for the same resources, but that's not the case at all. What happens is that the equines take out the really rough stuff, all the really tough fibrous grasses and the thistles and things that cows can't stomach. And that enables the sweeter, softer grasses to come up underneath that the cattle then benefit from, that they then enables them to put on weight. So I have this kind of rather sort of fanciful idea, I don't know, image in my head of how in the past you would have had herds of tarpan wandering through our landscape, and behind them you would have had herds of aurochs, the ancient cow, trailing in its wake, benefiting from the habitat that the horses had created for them.
You have been discovering so many relationships between living things, and this is just one example of that. I hope we have a chance to get into that a little bit more in just a bit. First, I want to go back to the very beginning of the decision that you and Charlie made to abandon the farm, as it were, not to leave the site, but to abandon farming. Could you relate how that came about and how this concept of rewilding entered into your own personal experience?
Yes, I mean, you know, we inherited this farm. It's 3,500 acres from Charlie's grandparents in the 1980s. And it was an intensive arable and dairy farm. We assumed when we took it over that that was going to be what we were doing, going to be doing for the rest of our lives. It was already a loss-making farm when we took over, and we assumed, I suppose, with the sort of arrogance of youth, that it was really down to his grandparents' mismanagement of the farm. They hadn't invested in infrastructure. They didn't know the latest technologies. And we thought we could turn the fortunes of the farm around. And so for 17 years, you know, we did what every good farmer is supposed to do. We invested in bigger machinery. We invested in infrastructure, made efficiencies. We diversified into ice cream and yogurt. We did everything we could think of to improve the fortunes of the farm. And of course, we put more and more chemicals on the land. We put more fertilizer, more pesticides, more fungicides, more herbicides, everything we could possibly do to increase the crop yields. But what we found was that after 17 years, we were still losing money, more than ever before. And the reason was we're on very, very heavy clay soil. It's just not cut out for industrial modern farming. We sit on 320 meters of this stuff. And in the winter, it's like porridge. And in the summer, it's as hard as concrete. You can literally put your whole arm up to your shoulder into a crack. It's just absolutely unforgiving stuff. And so we realized that we were just, you know, we could never compete with farms on better soil. But selling for us wasn't an option, really. We you know, this estate has been in the family for over 250 years. We realized we just wanted to do something that was going to work with the land rather than battling against it all the time. And we have always, Charlie, my husband and I, had a kind of amateurish love for nature. We've always have traveled the world to look at nature. I used to be a travel correspondent. And he grew up, my husband grew up in Africa and in Australia. And we never really once thought about the wildlife we could have in our own backyard. And it wasn't until we met this Dutch ecologist who had been doing some amazing experiments in rewilding on the continent in the Netherlands. And he really showed us how free-roaming herbivores, these, you know, large megafauna, can kickstart natural processes on even the most depleted land. They are the sort of the trigger, the sort of dynamism that can lift the glider back up into the sky so it can fly again, if you like. And the way they disturb the land, the way they trample and rootle and dung and their different vegetation preferences, all of these things recreate and generate habitats and in a kind of very dynamic way, a kind of kaleidoscope of habitats. So we just thought, wouldn't it be amazing to experiment and see if we could do this, if we could get life back onto our severely depleted post-agricultural land in the southeast of England, surrounded by conurbation and underneath the Gatwick stacking system, then we could prove a point that you could bring back nature anywhere.
The turning point really did come down to this piece of information from this fellow you met in the Netherlands, he was from the Netherlands, and it did have to do with this animals driving the fecundity of an area being the real key to getting things. It wasn't just an overarching, I want to have a wild place where I turn things over to nature. You started with a method, it sounds like.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you just leave your land to, you know, you just abandon it, if you've been farming it, particularly if you've been farming it chemically like we had for 50 or 60 years, it's kind of reached a state of a sort of catastrophic shift where it needs to kind of come to life again somehow. And if you just walk away and abandon it, what will happen is you'll get probably some scrub appearing, and eventually you'll get trees, and you may get a treescape arriving on that land. You'll get vegetation succession of some sort. But it's not necessarily the most biodiverse. Closed canopy woodland can actually be very species poor, very undynamic. And so what you want is that continuous battle, that sort of the battle between vegetation coming up and animals disrupting it. And it's that kind of battle that creates the messy margins where most of life thrives. It's a much more open landscape. It obviously has trees in it, it has scrub in it, it has wetland, it has all sorts of different varieties of habitat. But it's being driven the whole time by animal disturbance, and that's what's really rocket fuel for biodiversity.
Isabella Tree is author of Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. In our next hour here on Constant Wonder, after a short break, we're going to talk about two high-flying women pilots. These women jockeyed for the honor of becoming the first woman in space. I said becoming, not being the first woman in space, just wanting to become the first woman in space. Who won? If anybody. Stay tuned for the end of that story. We also have a firecracker of a guest to tell it for us on Constant Wonder after this.